lecture discussion number 66 on Genesis 1 through 19. Somebody told me to add the parenthetical disclaimer with exceptions, as they say that I don't particularly stay in Genesis 1:19, and I haven't covered all of Genesis 1:19, and all of that is absolutely true. I have left off, for example, Cain and Abel, because I have covered that at length before. I have the blood position on Cain and Abel for those who get this by CD. And I think the other positions are not defendable, because clearly the Bible is about blood. So when you say that Cain and Abel was not about blood, well, then I wonder how you can ignore the rest of the Old Testament, which is clearly about blood. Much of the New Testament as well is about blood, and today's sermon is about blood. So there's why I have the blood position. I'm consistent. And the answer for today is yes. Yes, I will move out of the ram this morning. So we're going to leave the ram behind. I've got it at the tail end of the presentation today. I've kind of broken it down so I can get some of these other things covered that I think are important. And having accomplished the ram, answered the reason for God placing within the wedding pattern, within marriage, his plan of redemption and salvation. That is what the ram does more than anything else, is it brings you to the discussion of Adam and Eve in the first wedding or the first marriage. And the reason for that is because the ram's horns are removed and they are the two shofars of Israel. One is blown at Revelation 4:1, which is the gathering or the abduction of the bride. It's part of that wedding step pattern, and the other is blown at the wedding of Israel and God himself in Exodus 19:16. So what is the deep meaning of this wedding? Why is the shofar blown at the weddings? Why is the ram in the wedding and the abduction of the bride of Christ and the church? Why is all of that connected? What's the relationship between the ram caught in the thorns and the crown of thorns on Christ's head? First thing you should note is by putting the crown of thorns on his head, he's God, he is doing that for a purpose. By putting those thorns on his head, clearly he's saying what? First and foremost, I'm the ram. This is a wedding. His crucifixion has weddings all throughout it. He is the ram, the crown of thorns. Christ is that ram, the one that was caught. He is the ram. And of course, so I have the ram and the thorns, and then I have the marriage symbolism, and then, of course, the separation of the priesthood, all of that tied up to the ram. And of course, when you're through with those and you've got those figured out, then Adam naming the fallen woman the mother of the living comes into play. See, that's one of the key mysteries of that whole marriage of Adam and Eve. Why, after she had fallen, did he call her the mother of life? We would have thought that he would have called her the mother of death, but he doesn't. Mother of life. Would we like more tables next week? Yes, we would, wouldn't we? You can purchase a seat at the table here. You can do that. Yeah, it was really funny. We've always, you know, my Wednesday nights are all tables. And most of my career, there has been tables. It is only when we went to the church format that we went to the chairs and the like. But if I could have my way, I would have tables constantly, because I see this as a classroom. Jeff made a great point. What are you going to do in this world? How are you going to survive it? Well, you better know something. Because if you don't know what you're doing, you'll just be another one get run over. You have to understand what it is you believe, because someone will ask you to explain it to them. And if you don't know, then you're just another one that doesn't know. There's lots of people that don't know. Try your best to be someone that knows. And all it takes is a lifetime of work. It's easy. But anyway, why did he name Eve the mother of living? And that's an important question. We'll try to solve that today. Because he understood something Adam did when he went through that process of the building of Eve, the fall of Eve, and his joining her in sin. And all these are things we're going to solve today. I'm going to answer every one of them. Do you believe that? You need to encourage me more. You really do. Yes. I'm going to solve them all today, and then we're going to move on to the ritual for cleansing healed lepers. Notice that we don't have a cleansing ritual for unhealed lepers. We have only a cleansing ritual for healed lepers. So we're going to move on to that, or what is effectively the mystery of the undivided two birds. So we're working our way down, Genesis 15, going to finish the ram, which is separation, which is marriage, and which is caught in thorns. And we're going to move on to the cleansing of the healed lepers, or the mystery of the undivided two birds. So everybody with me on that. But before we do that, as is our newest tradition, first, this interlude, this parenthesis. I'm going to not do progressive creationism today because of the events that have come up in the last week. You know what progressive creationism is, don't you? When I say progressive creationism, the first thing you say back to me is what? Who said death? Yay for you. He deserved something, you know, maybe pizza. Did I have death back there too? Death what? Expound on death. Death is the central issue of progressive creationism versus literal creationism. Both of them have death involved, but what does progressive creationism... Yes, death before Adam. Progressive creationism says death before Adam or death simultaneous with Adam. So if you have a progressive creationist position, or if you run into somebody that's trying to teach you progressive creationism, he will teach you that there is death before Adam, or that there is death simultaneous to Adam. And specifically, he will have Adam in the garden, okay? And he will have death out here. That is a skull and crossbones. In case you were wondering. No, then the skull, okay. Yeah. Okay. We'll get rid of it. Point is, bad things out here. Death is outside the garden while Adam is inside the garden, and they will tell you that Adam can look outside the garden as if it has some kind of plexiglass barrier, I suppose, and he can look through the Lexan, and he can see death happening all around him out there. So death has been placed by God in outside the garden, and God is the author of, the designer of, they will say, the progressive creationists. He is the designer of the violent, bloodied, suffering death as a means of either facilitating his ecological and biological creation, or just simply the tearing to pieces of one animal of another is what he wants. Does that make sense? It's either something that he has designed, all this death that's going on out here, because it's the best way for his creation to continue, the best way to facilitate his creation, or he just likes it. Those are your two choices. Pick one. So, progressive creationism says that God placed death into his creation with all the fear and the pain and the struggle and the sorrow. All you have to do is watch one of these animal shows, right? Those animals have emotion, and they have fear, and they struggle, and they mourn. Have two dogs. Have one die. Watch that dog mourn. It's alive. And they will say that God placed death in his creation with the fear and the pain and the struggle and the sorrow, and that it's intended and that it is foundational, and therefore it is necessary, and there's no other system that could be done but this death system. Nothing else would suffice. Now, you've had me say, ask you all the time, why does God do this, for example? Not this particular discussion, but why does God... Why did God pick a cross to die on? Because he could have picked anything, right? He could have been beheaded. But why did he pick a cross? Yes, because it was, let me help you, it is the only idea, it's the only thing that could work. It's the only one. He's omniscient. When he makes a decision, he makes the perfect, only right, most profound decision possible. And he sees both directions simultaneously. So when you say that he puts death into his system, then you are saying it is the only system that would work. He has to put death there, because if he didn't put death there, any other idea would be an attack on his omniscience. Do you understand that? I hope so. If you don't, it's okay. We'll argue about it later. I'm, of course, right. But I'll be merciful. Now, obviously, I hope it's obvious, I believe differently from the progressive creationist interpretation. I do not think that God intended death. I do not think that that is his system. I believe death, the predator prey, the sickness, the wasting, was a consequence of the result of sin, specifically Adam. And that is what's called the literal creationism position. And that then allows Genesis 6, 5 through 7 to make sense to me. Let me read it. See, otherwise it doesn't make sense to me unless you're a literal creationist. Then the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And he destroyed man and the animals. Genesis 6:11. The earth was corrupt before God, and the earth was filled with violence. See? Those two passages and many, many others make no sense if God is the designer of violence, or if God is the designer of corruption, or if God is the designer of sickness, or if God is the designer of death. If he designed the system of violence, predator, prey, and all this, then why is he mad that it's filled with it? And mad isn't the appropriate word. It's an anthropomorphism. Baloo the bear. That's me putting human characteristics on God. Progressive creationism at its core is an attack on the goodness of God and the omniscience of God, which, as you know, is the subject of what? When you are attacking the omniscience of God and the goodness of God, specifically where in Scripture are you fighting now? Kind of, but more to the point. Genesis 15. Genesis 15 is the resolution between the omniscience of God, the justice. See, you can't be just unless you're what? Unless you're omniscient. So we're battling there the solution to the omniscience of God and his goodness. Because justice and mercy, or justice and love, come in conflict, some would say. God says no, they're not in conflict. But I stray. The interlude today is not about progressive creationism. So you probably said, why is he yelling about it? Well, I can't help myself. Whenever I even bring up the subject, I have to just get this. Well, it's a deep characterological condition. And I can't stop myself from fighting back. And I need therapy, I know that. You don't insult me by saying so. I agree with you. But anyway, this morning is more along the lines of Jeff and Bill. And we didn't get together. We're not that organized here. This morning, because of the election and the upcoming transfer of power, I was asked, and I always get asked this around these kinds of events, but I got asked this week. Is the United States now at Ezekiel 38:13? Let's put that on the board. How many of you were asked this week about Ezekiel 38:13? Now, I know some of you were. How many of you discussed Ezekiel 38:13 this week? One. Was that at work? It was at work. I would expect that. See, that's a very good question. Is the United States at Ezekiel 38:13? Because if the United States very shortly ceases what it is now and becomes Ezekiel 38:13, then something very special is at hand. Special doesn't mean necessarily good for us. But something very special is at hand. The second shofar has either sounded or will sound. Now, don't misunderstand that, because the second shofar is imminent. See how I got the ram in here? We're waiting for that second shofar to blow. Now, when it blows, we don't know when it could blow. It could blow a couple of minutes from now. Would that be good news for all of us? Answer yes. Even teenagers, even young people. Don't cling to sewage. Just because you think your sewage is attractive. My sewage is better than your sewage. I don't want to go to a perfect place. I want to hang on to my little tiny piece of... Never mind. But that's what you're doing. That second shofar goes off. The saved are gathered in the air. And the second shofar is imminent. Could sound at any moment, either before or after the United States becomes Ezekiel 38:13. So it's very important to understand the imminency of the rapture. But let's get back to this. As to the question, is this country headed towards Ezekiel 38:13? Are we now on this path? And has the path begun to accelerate? In other words, are we screaming downhill? Are we picking up speed to Ezekiel 38:13? And I believe the answer to that is, without doubt for me, absolutely yes. And it's going to make, as I said, a very exciting time for us. Not particularly a time of admiration or esteem or respect. Actually, it is a time of dishonor and shame. But it'll be nonetheless interesting to watch the cable news people explain it. I will like and see that. So part of me wants to hang around, unless, of course, God provides some kind of video monitor in heaven, then I'll go for that. But otherwise, it'll be interesting to watch. This could be the time, everyone in this auditorium and in the kids' lap, this is the time when I wish these kids had stayed. I am absolutely confident that we're going to see Ezekiel 38:13. And Gore is going to see it for sure, and Becca is going to see it for sure, and these guys. I know their names. They're not sure anymore, though, are they? Anyway, I believe that the young people here, if you're below 25, and there, most of you here are below 35. I believe you're going to see this country hit Ezekiel 38:13. Unless, of course, it's a post-rapture issue. So, I hope that answers your question. Perhaps maybe a little more specification would be merited, huh? Who would want me to be more specific, to specificize, specificiality. Oh, one of those might not be a word, by the way, specificity. Which one's not a word, do you know? Oh, no, it's a specification is a word. That's a word. It's one of my favorites. Specificity is that people use it all the time, and I had to look it up, but it is a word. And specificize is a word. I can barely say that. Specificiality, we'll have to argue about that. Okay. Ezekiel 38 and 39 talks about the pre-tribulational invasion. It's about a war. Ezekiel 38 and 39 is the pre-tribulational invasion of Israel by a Russian-led confederacy of nations. That's what 38 is about. So 38 and 39, so forget 38:13 for now, but people are asking, how close are we to this Russian-led invasion, that this confederacy that comes towards Israel, that marches towards Israel, how close are we? When is it coming? Why is it coming? Who exactly is coming? What do they want? Why would they attack Israel? How close are we to it? What does God do to it? What does he do? This army that comes. He slaughters it, yeah. Israel doesn't slaughter it. Nobody else slaughters it. God slaughters it. Number one way he slaughters it is an earthquake. He also throws rocks at them. God's really good with rocks. He likes rocks. He knows how to use rocks really well. He hits things perfectly with rocks. He's a very good shot. He also causes confusion within the midst of them, and they turn on each other and kill each other. They start shooting. Now, a few of you have been to war. John has, and I know Jeff has seen at least parts of it, the aftermath. You know that confusion in war is a deadly thing. And we friendly fire is not something to be disregarded. It is a very, very difficult problem. And when you have an infantry that is in confusion and begins to shoot each other, that's a horrible thing. That's going to happen. God is going to confuse them. Does he confuse people? He does all the time. It's one of his methods. But the world will not see it as a supernatural, necessarily a supernatural thing, but Israel will. Israel will recognize that God did this. They would be unprepared for it and unable to stop it, and it looks like an overwhelming force. It's the Russian military, among others. Note that I began by saying that it is a pre-tribulational event, and understand that there is great debate here, heated debate over 38 and 39. And they fight over who's coming and when they're coming and why they're coming. And I'm going to give you my particular view, which is the pre-tribulational view. I say it's a pre-tribulational view because you got to solve a couple of problems. You've got to solve the 7 months, and you've got to solve the 7 years. And the only view that solves the 7 months and the 7 years is the pre-tribulational view. And not everybody agrees with me yet. But to suffice to say, as I just have, you've got to deal with these 7 months and 7 years. What are the 7 months and the 7 years? Now, there's 7 months of burying. Israel goes out and they bury these guys. It takes them 7 months. And then what do? They burn all that fuel. Oops, burn. So I've got the 7 months of burying and the 7 years of burning. Now, if I'm right up against the tribulation, how long is the tribulation? 7 years. I can't be burning during the tribulation. Why not, if I'm the nation of Israel? Why can't I be burning the Russian army fuel during the tribulation? I'm running for my life in the tribulation if I'm a Jew. I ain't burning nothing. I'm on the move. If it starts during the tribulation, if it's a tribulational event, as some will say to you, and we would call those people, wrong, yeah. But if you say it's a mid-tribulational event or it starts in the tribulation, then you've got them burning the fuel going into the millennium. Why do they need to do that? Plus, again, they're running for their lives in the tribulation. They'd be slaughtered by the millions. When Arnold Fruchtenbaum came here, I asked him what he thought would happen to the American Jew. You know what he told me? Dead. Won't survive tribulation. Lambs to the slaughter. Apostate Israel is what he would call them. But you have to solve the 7 years and the 7 months, and you also have to ask the restoration question. Is Israel currently restored in final faith? Obviously, they are not. Are they in partial unbelief? And I think that it is obvious they are in partial unbelief. What am I yammering about? I know. Make him stop. Okay. I get all that. Let's try again here. Ezekiel 38 and 39 contains one of the great in time prophecies of Scripture. Ezekiel tells of a war. God intervenes himself. Destroys this army that comes from the north. No other nation, though they exist, will come to Israel's defense. What I mean by that is that at the time of this invasion that is coming, there are still nations that are not hostile to Israel, but they don't get in the way of the Russian military. Russia does what Russia wants to do. Nobody stops them. Who can stop Russia today? United States can stop Russia. Who else could stop Russia? China could stop Russia. India might be able to stop Russia. You're talking about massive amounts of manpower, and India is a nuclear power. If India decided they wanted to throw their 200 million people at this gap, they could make a big mess for Russia. Russia couldn't take Afghanistan. Remember that. Now they're coming south with this army, and they think they need a lot, don't they? Who are they going after? Well, they don't know that. They think they're going after the Israeli military. How good is the Israeli military? Good enough that Russia doesn't believe they can take them without help. So consider all of that. But there are nations at this time of this invasion that are not hostile to Israel, but they sit it out. They don't interfere. There are some that are hostile to Israel, and they don't get involved either. Why wouldn't they get involved? Why would they be opposed to this invasion? Because they don't want the Russians in the Middle East, but they don't want to get in the way. And they're hoping for what? Pretty much a kill everybody fight. And then we'll move in after it's over. So the crux of this initial question is, where is the United States? Is the United States a 38:13 place? Okay, Ezekiel 38:13 says that there are some that oppose but don't help, and it's called Tarshish and the young lions, and that's a Hebrew idiom. Tarshish is three places in Scripture. One place is North Africa, one place is Spain, and one place is England. The young lions is a Hebrew idiom that is those countries that Tarshish has founded. And so most scholars believe Tarshish, England, and the countries it has founded no longer are on the side of Israel. Now do you understand Ezekiel 38:13? Because it specifically says that Tarshish is not on the side of Israel in this conflict. Are we at a place where the United States will not fight for Israel soon? Will not interfere? Will let Israel go? How close are we to that? Because if we're close to it, whoa, baby. Good to know about that second shofar. See, the coalition, England, United States, Australia, and Canada came together and did something unusual in this Afghan-Iraq war. It opposed somebody. It opposed the Russians, which isn't a surprise. It opposed the Iranians, which isn't a surprise. It opposed the Germans, which historically isn't a surprise. And it opposed the French. Now, that was a surprise. France sided with Germany and Russia against the United States-led coalition in the Afghan-Iraq conflict. Now, all of Ezekiel 38 and 39 requires certain very definitive elements to exist and be true. And they have never been true until now. First, the land being attacked has got to be in the possession of who? Israel. I got to have a land that I'm going to attack if I'm Russia, and Israel has to have it. When did Israel get that land? 1948. Okay? But that was just the beginning of the land. We couldn't attack then because Israel didn't have the land that Russia was going to fight in. See? The Jews that controlled Israel for the first time in 1900 plus years, 46 invasions, the war of the Israeli independence, Israel is in existence, reestablished after World War II, 1948, finally I can even begin talking about Ezekiel 38. But I couldn't even talk about it as a possibility until 1948, but I still couldn't talk about it in 1948 because it must also be true that the Jews control the mountains of Israel, which is Ezekiel 39, 1 through 16. By the way, this is the perfect place of the law of recurrence. Let me put that on the board so that you know you've got to read Jewish scripture written by Jews understanding recurrence, which means he'll give you 38 of Ezekiel, and then he'll write 39 right behind it, Ezekiel will be, and they're not concurrent in time, they're not chronological. What they are is recurrence, which means that 38 gives me information, 39 gives me more specific information. It is the same chronology, just added information. You must understand that in order to get it. So it's true, it must be true, that not only does the Israel control, the Jews control this land, but they got to control the mountains. They did not control the mountains until when? 1967. Then the Jews control the mountains and the land. Now it is possible. Excuse me. It is possible for Ezekiel 38 and 39 to happen. You are the first generation to live. You are living in a time where it is possible for Ezekiel 38 and 39 to happen. It has not been possible before. 1967, the Jews took control of the mountains of Israel from the Jordanian Arabs. So only since 1967 have both of these elements been true. Only since 1967 could Ezekiel 38 and 39 have occurred. So, obvious question, how close are we to it? Will it occur in your lifetime? On top of that, I need Magog-Gog. We'll get to that in a second. I need a Magog-Gog. It has to exist, and it has to be hostile. It has to be willing to attack. Now, don't confuse Magog-Gog with Magog-Gog. Does that make sense to anyone? There is two Magog-Gogs. Don't confuse your Magog-Gogs with your Magog-Gogs. Isn't it neat that one person knows that? We can throw things at him later. But don't, one is Ezekiel 38, 39. The other is Revelation 27 through 10. They're two different events. No time to explain that this morning. But just know that 38, 39 is pre-tribulational and Revelation 20 is post-millennial. Now, I didn't mean I mean anything to you, but don't confuse your Magog-Gog with your Magog-Gog. You got that worked out, you're in great shape. Okay, let's go read. Ezekiel 38. Quite the little interlude here. Are we going to get to the ram? I promised you that we would. I promised. 38, Ezekiel, verse 1. Now the word of the Lord came to me, saying, Son of man, that, by the way, is a title for Christ. It means federal head. Son of man, set your face against Gog of the land of Magog, the prince of Rosh, Meshech, and Tubal, and prophesy against him and say, Thus says the Lord God, Behold, I am against you, O Gog. What's your first question? Why is he against him? The prince of Rosh, Meshech, and Tubal. I will turn you around, put hooks into your jaws, and lead you out with all your army, horses and horsemen, all splendidly clothed, a great company with bucklers and shields, all of them handling swords. Persia, Ethiopia, and Libya are with them. Now, not all agree that's Libya, by the way. We'll get to that in a minute. Are with them, all of them with shield and helmet. Gomer and all its troops, the house of Togarmah from the far north and all its troops, many people are with you. I want to focus on Rosh, Meshech, and Tubal. Now, Rosh, the derivative that we say today for Rosh is Russia, Meshach has converted over the years, over the generations, to Moscow. Tubal has, I have to spell it correctly, has converted to Bolsk. So those ancient words that are in Ezekiel, these are the modern day equivalent. That is why we have the Russian-led Confederacy. And it always says to you over and over again, and if you read 38:15 and 39:2, they are from the uttermost parts of the north. If you put Jerusalem, okay, and you go straight north, straight, absolutely straight north, what do you hit? Moscow. It's perfect. Boom. God is so lucky. It's amazing how lucky he is. Rosh, Meshech, Tubal are tribes of the ancient world that occupied the areas that are now modern-day Russia, Iran, and Turkey. Okay? And as I said, Meshech actually is converted to Moscow. That's the actual conversion over time. Persia, and we read Persia, Persia, Ethiopia. Persia clearly is Iran, and Gomer is Germania, the Goths. And as you study ancient writings, you will see this slow change from Gomer into Germania. And after those, there's difficulty and disagreement arise among scholars. But Russia, Turkey, Iran, and Germania are not in question. So at least we can identify those as this confederacy. This Russian-led confederacy attacks. No nation comes to Israel's aid. Israel must be in unbelief, in an existence, but in a state of unbelief. And what is it that they don't believe, according to Scripture? They must be in a state that Christ is not the I Am. Jesus Christ is not God. That must be a state they're in. And they must not believe that Jesus Christ is the Messiah. And that is the current state of Israel today. So they are gathered in partial unbelief. A nation of Israel exists. The Jews have control of the mountains. Russia is openly hostile to them. So is Iran. So is Turkey. All we need for sure is Germany, parts of France. And we'll argue over whether or not Ethiopia and Somalia is part of this. But at least we can see many elements of it. All of this is either true now or very, very close to being true. So why does Russia come? What are they after? And God wants them to come. See, Russia thinks something, but God's thinking something different. That's a big problem, by the way. Don't be in that position if you can. You stay out of it. Do your best to try to do what God is thinking. As I can't remember what military man said it or president said it. It's very old. I think it was Roosevelt or Theodore, but I'm not positive of that. So the point is that don't worry about if God is on our side. Worry about if we're on God's side. Why does Russia come? It says that Russia comes because of spoil and riches. Russia's coming after the money. They see money here, an economic opportunity. And notice that in all those countries that I named, Germania, Germany, Iran, Turkey, Russia, even Ethiopia, Somalia, none of them are what? None of them are Arabs. Persians are not Arabs. Now, they may be Islam. They might be Muslim. But they're not Arab. The Arabs protest. Doesn't mean they're on Israel's side. But they protest the invasion. They don't want Russia in there any more than we do. The United States protests. I can see the protests. Where are we going to protest this? Security Council of the United... United Nations. God must just be... He must think that is the funniest thing ever. United Nations. The nations will unite, all right. Against who? Against God. That's the second Magog. And then, of course, we have Armageddon as well. But the point being that I can see the United States, Australia, Canada, Great Britain protesting this Russian invasion, but not being able to stop it, or not being willing to stop it. So you got to ask some questions. How does that happen? The U.S. military is not present, it's not in the way, and it won't be ordered in the way. How do we get there? How far away from there are we? That's the question that I got asked this week, because that's 38:13 that describes that. How far away are we from that? If we are close to it, let's say it happens next year, what should we do? Yeah, go into debt. That's right. I mean, here comes, baby. We got her made now. If it happens that fast, and remember, those of you who are my age here are better, and don't nod your head, you'll be identified, mocked, and scorned by the younger one. But if you remember how fast the Berlin Wall came down, how quickly the Soviet Union split apart, what is going to happen to the United States where it either splits apart, has some kind of natural disaster, has some kind of economic turmoil, something happens to where it sits out a major invasion of the nation of Israel. And Russia is coming for economic reasons. It's after something. Russia sees a prize, but God hooks them in the jaws. Remember that in Ezekiel? He hooks them. He's pulling Russia. He wants Russia to come. He wants Germany to come down there. He wants Turkey to come. He wants Iran to come. Why does God want them to come towards Israel? He's pulling them. They think they're going after riches, but they're not. What's happening to them? They're being pulled. They don't know they're being pulled. So why is God putting them on? He wants them where? He wants them on the mountains of Israel. Why does he want them there? He's going to kill them there. Why is he going to kill them there? He's going to slaughter them all. This massive army is coming into Israel. Is Israel scared, by the way? They're scared. They're going to be destroyed. God intervenes and destroys and said, what does that do to the nation of Israel? It begins the process of turning them towards Christ. Okay? Doesn't quite do it, but it begins the process. God intends to kill them all. Why? Why is he going to kill the Russian and the German and the Turkish and the Iranian army? Why is he doing it? And I left out the others, but those for sure. Why is he doing it? Eventually, let me just take it back. Let me make me more as specific as I can. He's going to kill Russians and he's going to kill Germans. Why? Why? You're old enough. Because they killed Jews. God remembers. When did they kill Jews? World War I, World War II. They were killing Jews as long as they could find a Jew to kill. And God is tired of it. So this isn't good news for Russia and Germany. He not only kills their army, he burns their countries. And the Jews get it. I can give you one piece of advice. Don't kill Jews. Okay? If the United States president can do one thing that is smart, it is defend the nation of Israel. It's interesting to notice that upon the election, the first thing that Putin and Medvedev have done, they've responded to our presidential election by doing what? Did you notice? They're putting missiles on the Polish border. Russia is moving. Now, what causes them to go into the Middle East? What spoil are they looking for? And they know the United States will not interfere. And as Troy alluded, the purpose of this is not the same as the purpose of the tribulation. The purpose of the tribulation is worldwide revival. The purpose of the tribulation is to end sin, end the wickedness of the wicked ones. That's the Antichrist and the false prophet and Satan. And then, of course, is to turn and break the will of the stiff-necked people, the nation of Israel. This, Ezekiel 38, is part of that, but it's not tribulational. Okay? That was fun. Now, But it's a prophecy of great importance. You have to know it. You're going to have to explain it. It's a prophecy that I recommend that you take the time to study. All the pieces are not quite in place, but I think they're coming quickly. I think you're going to see it. You young guns, you're going to see it. 10 years, 20 years. You have to understand the 7 months of burying and the 7 years of burning. Okay. Now, back to the sermon. We'll start the sermon now. I got plenty of time. Got 10 minutes. The ram is equal to marriage. The horns are blown at weddings. Two significant wedding events. The abduction of the bride of Christ, the church. See how it fits into this? Because does the abduction? Is the abduction of the bride, the blowing of the shofar, does that trigger Ezekiel 38? People wondered that for years. Have you heard that the abduction of the bride, or the blowing of the shofar, Revelation 4:1, which is the rapture of the church, have you heard people say to you that starts the tribulation? Anybody said heard that? You haven't heard that here, because it isn't true. The rapture of the church does not start the tribulation. What starts the tribulation? The signing of the covenant by the confirming of the covenant between the Antichrist and Israel. That starts the tribulation. Will we, the church, the saved, see that event? No, we're gone. Do we get to see Ezekiel 38:13? It's a pre-tribulational event. Maybe. But the rapture of the church, if I rapture the church, what percentage, Jeffrey, what percentage of your army, right? Air Force? What percentage of the Air Force is Christian? 33%, if he's right, gone. Taken out. Do you know, by the way, do you ever read the story? Now I'm really getting lost here. The sinking of the Arizona and Pearl Harbor. Do you know what percent of those sailors on that ship were confessed, believing, evangelical Christian? Do you know what the estimate is? Yeah, it was in the high 90s. They wanted to say 100, but they figured there was one guy faking it just to get along. That whole ship was saved. See, the American military believed that they were doing righteous in World War II. They believed that was a great generation, no question about it. Believed they were fighting evil on the side of God. Okay. But if the rapture takes the military out, that's definitely a factor. So the blowing of the shofar, marriage, the substitute, the separation. Remember the context, Abraham's question. How can I know that I will be saved and I'll keep being saved and I'll be saved for all eternity and I'll never not be saved? How can I know that? I've kind of paraphrased that, can you tell? But that's what we ask all the time. How can I know I'm going to be saved? I don't feel saved. I don't look like I'm saved. I don't think I'm going to be saved. Oh, no. Do I need to give more money? No, you don't. As tempting as that is for us pastors, keep running with that. It isn't true. Money won't save you. How can I know that I will be saved and kept saved for all of eternity? See, that's what he's asking. And God answers heifer, goat, ram, two birds. And now taking the ram, God answers marriage. The ram means marriage. The God-given first, God-directed human institution ordinance is marriage. It's the first one. And so naturally, Abraham would know to go look at marriage, and he would, between Adam and Eve. Because God said, inside of marriage is Yeshua. Inside of marriage is Jesus. Inside of marriage is salvation. Now, I'm not surprised to see marriage under assault, redefined and diminished. I'm not surprised by that. I'd expect that. Why? Because hidden inside of marriage is what? Christ. I tear marriage down, I can get Christ removed, right? Or I can try. I am surprised. Okay, I'm not really surprised. That's a pretend surprise. That the church today does not shout out, teach the truth that is hidden in marriage. Remember Ephesians 6:12. Noting first its context. What do I do at weddings? Kristen and Chase aren't here because I told them when they came in for counseling this week I was going to blow a ram's horn. And I tried to be as serious as I could, and I thought that would really freak Kristen out. But no, she thought that was a great idea. Now I'm in real trouble. Inside that marriage that we're going to do here is hidden Christ. Remember Ephesians 6:12, but you got to note that its context is Ephesians 5:22 through 33, and that's marriage. Ephesians 6:12 comes right after marriage, right after the commandment to honor father and mother. And here's what it says, Ephesians 6:12. For we do not struggle against flesh and blood. When I see flesh and blood, what do I think? Marriage. Get into that in a minute. It also means something different here. But against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of darkness, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places. In other words, he's saying to you, Paul, in the context of a marriage, in context of the marriage in Ephesians 5, he's saying you need to remember that you're struggling against not human beings. What are you struggling against? You're struggling against the angelic hosts, the heavenly, the demons, the fallen angels. The demonic hosts saw the first marriage and they figured out very fast what God was doing in it. And they attack, and they really attack in Genesis 6, but they figured out what was going on with Adam and Eve right off the bat. And if they didn't figure it out then, they knew something special was there and they figured it out later. They're up to speed now. Quickly, note that the fallen angels, they saw the throne of God, they heard the horns, they heard all the noise, they've seen all of this, and they still fell. We go through our life, we're pretty much blind, aren't we? We don't see anything. We don't touch anything. See, note the contrast. Man does not see. Man is blind. Man must have what? Faith in things not seen. Ask why the difference. Anywho, where was I? Oh, yeah, marriage. Marriage is the answer to this question. How can I be sure I'm saved and I'll stay saved? Adam and Eve. Let's go through it. Adam is dead. Deep sleep, dead. His blood and his flesh are taken out of him and used to give life, build life. And woman, she's not made from dust, she's made from the flesh, the blood, and the bone from a person who is dead. And then it's my view, notice I gave you the dead view, it's my view that Adam was what? Resurrected. Because he is a type of Christ. He's identified as a type of Christ in Romans. He's a type of Christ. And then Eve was presented to him, spotless, filled with his blood and his flesh. That's the pattern for the church today. It's exactly the same as Christ. Christ, out of his death, out of his body, comes his blood and his flesh. And we are the church gathered together, and his blood and his flesh is put inside of us, and we are presented to him spotless. That's how you know you're eternally saved. Does that make sense? Because you got what? See, Abraham said, I ain't going to be eternally saved. I'm not going to make it. Because I'm who? I'm a fallen man. How are you going to fix me? God said, marriage. Abraham said, oh, okay, that makes sense to me. His marriage means someone must die. I have to take his blood. I have to take his flesh. I have to make somebody else with it. And then I resurrect him and present it to him. You're going to live eternally because why? You will be eternally saved because you have his blood, his flesh inside of you. He pulls us up in the air and he puts on immortality. We put on immortality. God's definition of immortality is his blood and his flesh inside of us. Are the lost immortal? God's definition. No, they don't have the flesh and the blood of Christ inside. We're going to be changed, 1 Corinthians 15:50 through 55, 1 Thessalonians 4:15. We're going to have perfect blood, perfect flesh, given to us, the bride, through marriage from the bridegroom, Christ, after a death process and then resurrection. That's how you know. That's his plan. So this obvious question, why does he need to die to do this? See, when you read deep sleep, what did you think of Adam? Yes, Pat's in deep sleep right now, isn't it? Okay. Throw something at Pat. It's okay. He works late. Did she thump him? Okay. I don't blame you. I sleep through the sermons a lot myself. It's okay. Why did he need to die? When you see deep sleep, did you think, oh, he's in God just put him under anesthesia? Is that what you thought? He didn't really die? Did Christ really die? Or did he just kind of swoon? You know, one's a type, right? Why did Christ, what is the purpose of death? Why the death of the bridegroom in order to build the bride? It's not too many volunteers at the blood bank. It's if everyone gives blood, dies, right? It'd be pretty hard to do that. Come on down, donate blood. Oops, you're going to die. Why death? Why did Christ have to die in order to give his blood? Does he have to die? Why can't he just have a pitcher of blood over here? Everybody come up before the buffet. You know, here's some. Listen, the transubstantiation, that's exactly what one large denomination believes. When you come up and you get the bread and the cup, it actually becomes the blood and the flesh of Christ when it enters into you. They actually teach that, contrary to common sense and modern science and the Bible. A couple of those problems. Why does Christ have to die? He could just supply you blood. Why? Do you ever answer that to yourself? Why? It is the only way. Why is it the only way? The transfusion way won't work. He must die. What did you say? Justice. Ooh, he took it right off of the page. Why death? Judicial, justice, fairness, goodness, right. Death solves all of those. If God doesn't die, he's not good. You have to think that through. He has to die in order to be good. He has to die in order to be fair. He can't be fair unless he's good. Where are we now? What passage of Scripture? What chapter? What book? Please say Genesis 15. Adam knew all this, by the way. He wasn't deceived. 1 Timothy 2:14. Adam knew death. Musicians, Adam knew death, not from seeing animals die, not from seeing animals kill each other and tear each other to pieces. Adam knew death. Adam knew death because of the building process of Eve. So now you have the great question of Adam. Adam knew that death and blood would fix Eve. He knew that. So why didn't he choose that? The great question of Adam's sin. If he knew, I have a fallen wife, all I got to do is get blood and flesh to her. And she's changed and restored and resurrected. Did he have blood that was capable of doing it? Did he have flesh that was capable? Could we go back and do this operation again? Drain her out, put new blood and flesh in her, start all over. Take her essence, which is her soul, and put her in this new body. Could we do it? Could he just say, God, I got a problem here. She ate the fruit just like, well, we expected that, didn't we? I'm kidding. So we got to fix it. We got to reproduce what we originally did. Put me to death again. Take out more flesh, more bone. Make a new body for her. Go ahead, blow that one up. Take that soul. Put that soul in there and let's go again. Would that have worked? If it would have worked, why didn't Adam do it? Now remember, Adam is really, really, really smart. Can't be deceived by Satan, wasn't deceived by Satan. Do not put my stupidity on Adam. He thought that through. Would it have worked? What's the answer? Must not have worked. Great question of the sin of Adam. Let's rise and be dismissed.